afternoon. It's March 22nd, 2017. I am opening the public hearing on Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Public Safety. We're hearing House Bill 5004, and I believe we've got coming up is Director Colette Peters. And who's coming up with you? And I think Heidi, because we left off yesterday. And before we start, and I don't know if the rest of the committee has received this, but there was there's a bill when there was an article that was done by Mr. Friedman, and I may want to ask the good director some questions because it is about a subject that we talked about earlier, and that was mandatory overtime leave. And I just have a couple of questions, and you can bring them back to us rather than to delay time. And one of the questions, because the bill that was under question is House Bill 2104, and talking about triple pay for mandatory overtime hours. And so my one question is the question of how many, what's our vacancy rate is now for DOC, and you can get all that back to us. You don't have to do it today, but that's one question. And the other one question that I have, because the article talks about the one of the major problems would be the inability to recruit and retain over in the eastern part of the state. And so if you can give me some response back in writing as to the problems that you are encountering for those cities that are outside of the valley and the metropolitan Portland area. And in addition, there was a reference made that the agency was putting together a work group to address the mandatory overtime with the hopes of cutting that rate by about 50% in a decade. And so my question is, that's about 5% annually, and whether we can do better than 5%. So those are the questions that I have, and if you can get them back to me, Director Peters. Thank you.
Madam Co-Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I am Colette Peters, Director of the Department of Corrections, and we'll be happy to provide that data for you. You all know that staff wellness is one of our top initiatives and one of my top concerns. We also know that mandatory overtime is a big contributor to the lack of staff wellness, and so this is something that has been on our radar. Wow, I sound like Mr. Gower. radar, and it's something that we're taking very seriously. Your data points are correct. We do want to reduce it by 20% in 4 years and 50% in 10 years, so we can talk about the ability to hit those marks.
One of the, just in case someone is listening, one of the points that was made in the article is that the particular piece of legislation of talking about triple time would bust our budget, and that is absolutely correct. That I'm sure I don't have to the numbers will probably mean that we will have to be asking people not to send any individuals to your community. So anyway, just but I would appreciate having a response just in case. And for those members of the who have not seen this article, I will have it copied, and so that you have copies of it.
I lived it.
You lived it?
Yeah, that was the committee.
Was your committee? Mm-hmm.
Representative Sanchez.
Yeah. Representative Sanchez.
Co-chair Winters, there was actually another piece in the testimony in judiciary about specifically that overtime and mandatory overtime at Coffee Creek was an issue as well, and maybe a lack of staffing at Coffee Creek as well. I was wondering if there's a And there was, I asked specifically about that, and the response that I received was that people, of course, were being pulled away from that facility because they could pay better. I didn't ask whether or not there's a difference in pay scale at Coffee Creek versus any of the other institutions, or is it simply about location?
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Sanchez, it's about the fact that Coffee Creek Correctional Facility is in the metro area, and the counties in the metro area pay more than the state does. So they're not being stolen from Coffee Creek to another state-run facility, but to a county position. Okay. Thank you. We will be happy to tease out the overtime numbers and the recruitment issues by facility, because they're very different from Coffee Creek to Eastern Oregon to Madras. So we'll tease those numbers out in the response back to the committee.
Follow up.
So that's what I was wondering about, whether, and I didn't think that it was a pay necessarily, but is there a difference between, because other facilities, Columbia River, of course, is in the metro. Different prisons are here in Salem, relatively metro area. Is it some difficulty with Coffee Creek itself? Is there some? I don't know. I'm curious to find out why we might have a lack of folks there and a bit of a turnover situation there at Coffee Creek.
Madam Co-Chair and Representative Sanchez, we'll make sure that specifically is in our response.
Thank you.
I
think, Director Peters, it might be well to actually, of the 14 cities, just to demonstrate where the problems are and where you're having the higher utilization of mandatories. That might help.
Madam Co-Chair, happy to provide that, and we'll also include the corrective actions that we've been pushing forward to help solve this problem. Thank you.
Thank you.
And with that, I will turn it over to Assistant Director Heidi Stewart.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Heidi Stewart, Assistant Director of the Offender Management and Rehabilitation Division with the Oregon Department of Corrections. Yesterday, we just touched on our Education, Training, and Treatment Unit. So we'll pick up today on slide 83, which is talking about our GED programs within our facilities. In order to ensure that I give my peers enough time, I'm probably going to go through some of this stuff pretty quickly. So if I start going too fast, please slow me down if you need me to. Our 2015 intake population shows 37% of offenders coming into our custody did not have a verified GED or high school diploma. When I sat before this committee in 2015, I reported a decline in GED completions due to the 2014 implementation of the more rigorous and computer-based GED testing system. I am happy to say, in collaboration with our community college partners, we've improved student outcomes and since the last time I was with you. This chart is a little deceiving because it looks like we haven't done well. The reason is we're looking at releasing individuals. The data included in the 2014-2015 bar reflects many people who received their GED under the old GED testing system. As of February 28th, we had 1,002 individuals earn their GEDs this biennium, and our completion rate continues to climb. Did you know Oregon Corrections has a GED pass rate of 93%, which is among the highest pass rates in the nation? And to put this 93% into perspective, I'll share some statistics with you. The overall pass rate for corrections GED test takers nationally is 80%. The overall pass rate for non-corrections test takers in Oregon is 90%. The overall pass rate for non-corrections test takers nationally is 83%. So I'm proud of the work our community college partners are doing through the work of their teachers and our inmate tutor programs. This graph shows the releasing medium and high-risk men and women who successfully completed treatment during the past five fiscal years. Between 2012 and 2013, we saw a high level of low-risk individuals enter our treatment programs, which accounts for the decline in those two bars. As you can see, as the graph shows, we have since remedied the situation, and the numbers are picking back up. So we are putting high and moderate-risk individuals in those treatment programs. Yesterday, I mentioned the majority of men and women will release from prison, and most will go on to do good things. Recently, one of our treatment programs at Coffee Creek Correctional Facility hired a new case manager who graduated from the very program which she is now employed. The program changed her life, and she is overcome with excitement to give back by helping others like her make positive changes in their lives. We know that treatment and behavioral change programming is another area that contributes to our low recidivism rate, and we prioritize treatment programs for those with a high need coupled with a medium to high risk to recidivate. Research continues to show the importance of gender-responsive programming. Because of this, we have worked closely with our contractor pathfinders to redesign our women's intensive cognitive-based reentry program. This program will begin to use gender-responsive curricula and intervention strategies in the coming month. Another of our Destination 2026 strategic initiatives is the creation of an automated program evaluation tool. Today, we don't have a timely way to know how effective our programs are. To solve this, OMR is working closely with our research team to develop automated research reports that show data trends in each of our treatment programs, allowing us to act quickly if a program gets off course. That tool is nearly complete, and we should have our first official report in June. Due to our agency's budget shortfall, we've had to do something we've been able to avoid in past biennia. We've cut treatment programs. Our 25-bed outpatient treatment program at the Santiam Correctional Institution was eliminated, as was our 106-bed residential treatment program at the Deer Ridge Correctional Facility in Madras. The department now offers 6 treatment programs, 4 alcohol and drug treatment programs, and 2 cognitive-based programs with an alcohol and drug treatment component. Unfortunately, there is always a gap between the resources that we do have and the number of individuals that we can serve, and that gap will grow.
Question on your treatment programs, and have you been able to determine how effective those programs are? You know, it's and whether or not they're actually giving you what you expect for outcomes?
We do, not on a regular basis like this report will provide to us. So now we'll get monthly reports that show how effective these programs are. In the past, we would get maybe a yearly evaluation on the program. We did a trial run with this tool. All of our programs are in the effective area, but we really want to move them to be more effective. So as these reports come out, we'll be meeting with our programs and trying to figure out how we can become more effective and use our resources more wisely. So they are effective, but we want to do better. Does that answer your question?
Never mind. Go ahead. Keep going.
Okay. So a programs and services unit covers a broad range of OMR activity, including volunteer services, behavioral change programs, family advocacy, transition services, and inmate services. Through the work of our contractors, Program Services provides 3 types of behavioral change programming designed for targeted populations inside our institutions. Cognitive restructuring programs focus on our higher risk, higher need adults and general population. The curriculum for the cognitive programs was recently replaced with a more robust curriculum that incorporates principles of effective intervention. In the near future, our contractors will replace the curriculum at the Coffee Creek Correctional Facility with a gender-responsive curriculum for women. The Parenting Inside Out is an Oregon-grown skills training program that has been reviewed by SAMHSA and is the highest-rated parenting service for criminal justice-involved adults on the National Registry of Evidence-Based Programs and Practices. As part of our efforts to optimize the use of special housing beds in Oregon, we introduced the Challenge Program for men housed in our intensive management unit. The IMU houses some of the department's most dangerous adults in custody. Work is already underway to further evolve the program through a Bureau of Justice Assistance funded grant that partners us with the University of Cincinnati, Portland State University, and Pathfinders of Oregon. Each adult in custody is invited to participate in the Road to Success program just prior to their release. Road to Success courses address common reentry barriers by providing skill-based programming. Our 14 correctional facilities spread across the state are the most religiously active and spiritually diverse pockets in Oregon. With the assistance of our volunteers, services are provided for Protestants, Catholics, Jews, Muslims, Buddhists, humanists, Native Americans, and much more in many different languages, including Lakota, Spanish, Russian, and American Sign Language. These volunteers, alongside our 21 chaplains, served nearly 60% of all the adults in custody in 2016. Religious, spiritual, and sacred programming in our prisons is not only assures we are compliant with the First Amendment guarantees outlined in the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act, or LUPA, but it positively impacts the culture and tone of our prisons, providing space for solace, reformation, and hope. We care deeply about the solace and hope of victims as well and serve them through victim services. This unit provides victims across the state with Vine, an anonymous and free-to-use service that sends time-sensitive information about an offender's custody status through email, text, and call. The responsibility letter bank is something we plan to begin offering next biennium, pending passage of Senate Bill 16, a legislative concept we propose to protect the confidentiality of this new service. The responsibility letter bank is a victim-driven program. Our incarcerated men and women can deposit approved letters in a bank, and if the victims choose, they can check the bank to see if a letter has been deposited for them. We provide this alongside our facilitated dialogue program, which establishes a safe environment for victims to ask questions of the individual that harmed them and let them know how the crime affected them. Often people reconnect with or discover for the first time faith while incarcerated. For over a decade now, our religious services unit has offered Home for Good in Oregon, HGO, a faith-based reentry effort that helps men and women continue the practice of faith while connecting to needed spiritual and social resources for reentry into the community. In 2016, we completed a life cycle analysis of the program and have established new processes and procedures to further streamline HGO. In January, we received word from an HGO sponsor family that one of our HGO participants, Pep, passed away. I want to read an excerpt from the touching email we received that memorialized his life and really speaks to the heart of HGO. So many good memories with this guy. There are several things in life that most of us, including myself, take for granted. Things that Pep had never experienced before. Going to Timberline and having hot cocoa, having a birthday party, sailing, coaching a child in basketball, Christmas, hockey games, and bingo scratch-it lottery tickets. But most importantly was him learning what it was to be family. He and his younger siblings were abandoned by their parents, left on the streets of Portland. That was his childhood. That was his home. But with us, he was our brother and Uncle Pep. Though his life remained full of challenges, we saw a heart transformation. We couldn't be more proud of this guy, for the love he showed us was genuine and life-changing. So that's HGO in a nutshell. Reentry and Release is a statewide program providing planning and release preparation services and is responsible for the coordinated reentry and release planning services for over 4,800 individuals releasing from the Department of Corrections each year. Release planning includes developing an individualized release plan, which encompasses supervision requirements, community-based support services, continuity of medical and mental health care, including referrals for appointments. This includes applying for Medicaid through the Affordable Health Care Act, Social Security benefits, and other state and federal benefits. This unit staffs the Governor's Reentry Council, which is co-chaired by Director Peters. The Reentry Council is a statewide leadership group comprised of state, county, and local agencies and community organizations working collaboratively to improve the success and safety of transition from incarceration to the community.
Would you tie how the reentry planning actually connects with TransLeave?
Yes, Co-Chair Winters. When a person releases to transitional leave, we actually back that release planning up by the 90 days. So a release plan is prepped. It does go to the parole board. There are conditions of transitional leave within that release plan. And then once all of that is approved by the parole board and approved by the county, the individual will release to short-term transitional leave. So it's the same release planning that goes into a regular release.
But my point is that all the players that are involved before the person returns or goes to the community.
Co-Chair Winters, all the players involved in the release planning are still involved. Yes, exactly. Thank you. I have been a public servant in Oregon for over 20 years, and while many things are important to the citizens of Oregon, the one question I hear over and over again is, are we using our dollars and people wisely? Part of ensuring that we're spending our resources wisely includes skillfully managing contracts that abide by statutes and rules. With this in mind, I worked over the last biennium to realign staffing patterns in my division to create the Policy and Business Services Unit. PBS manages all of OMR contracts and government agreements, of which we have many, monitors adherence to statutes, rules, and policies, and continuously improves program delivery. In doing this, we have discovered cost savings in areas where our contracts need to be rewritten to accurately reflect our agreements with our contractors. The unit has had its hands in every program In every program improvement, cost-saving strategy, and innovation I've mentioned in my presentation. I will add one more. In the last biennium, we focused on our often overlooked statewide mailrooms for cost savings and process improvement. We built a mailroom database allowing our staff to generate labels with inmates' names and ID numbers for incoming mail. This may seem very ordinary until you realize that prior to this database, staff were handwriting names and 8-digit state ID numbers on mail labels. In December of 2016, our mailrooms received nearly 150,000 pieces of mail. That's a lot of staff time rerouted from handwriting labels to doing thorough security reviews and customer service. Another important role PBS plays is a program innovation. In the last biennium, our staff have identified meaningful and cost-effective program ideas that leverage existing resources. We want to seize these opportunities, allowing us to realign and consolidate services. These programs hold great promise for increasing self-efficacy, quality of life in prisons, and positive reentry outcomes. The
Representative Barker.
Thank you. So, and you don't need to move the slides back, but on the mail, so when the mail comes in, is it read? Do you have to go through every piece? And also, I wonder, I remember a few years back there was problems. I don't remember if it was in Oregon where people were putting LSD on the stamps, so then the stamps had to be removed and all that. And I just wondered, because it sounds like that's a very time-consuming procedure you're going through.
Co-Chair Winters, Brett Barker, we don't thoroughly read each piece of mail coming in, but we scan it and we're looking for certain items and certain things within those course. Yeah, because we can't read word for word, obviously, every piece of it. But we are scanning it. We are looking for drugs coming into the institution, certainly.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Along that line, follow up, the machine, or did you purchase the machine that would actually detect those new drugs that you could put on a stamp?
Co-Chair Winters, I do not believe we have a machine to detect that, but I will go back.
The one that
we do not know.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Another important role PBS play, okay, program innovation. So let's talk about the LEAP program. Learning, Entrepreneurship, Arts, and Production is the modern expression of the 1850s Oregon Territorial Prison Saddle Shop. Today, like 150 years ago, people in custody become craftsmen and women with marketable skills for use upon reentry. In the last biennium, we partnered with the Small Business Development Council of Oregon to provide LEAP participants with a course in business management. As part of this evolution, we've proposed Senate Bill 184 to update statute allowing us to use modern-day technology for the selling of inmate-made goods. For over a decade, Dr. Ann Shindo has provided adults in custody with cutting-edge, peer-to-peer-led health promotion programs, including Stanford University's Chronic Disease Self-Management. Preliminary reviews of our health promotion program shows marked and sustained increases in participants' health-related self-efficacy, as well as cost savings in the form of fewer outpatient hospitalizations, less medication use, and more appropriate medical encounters overall. When I present to you next biennium, I anticipate having exact dollars and outcomes to speak of. OMR is responsible for the core measures of tracking the number of social support contacts a person has in our custody. These are contacts outside of traditional visiting, and Mr. Gower spoke about it a little bit yesterday, showed pictures, so I won't spend a lot of time explaining that, except to say that to begin collecting data in this area, we've had to standardize definitions, develop automation for tracking, and set targets, and we're in the midst of rolling all of that out. So I've discussed some of the many challenges, improvements, and cost savings of my division throughout this presentation. I will close by highlighting four we are particularly proud of. The first one that our director spoke about in her opening comments, so I won't spend a lot of time talking about Social Security cards and birth certificates, except to say that we are improving processes to bring that 37% up even higher. As a matter of fact, hot off the press, I checked with my team. They got an updated number, and we're now at 42% as of yesterday. So that number continues to climb. We implemented the Affordable Care Act, expanding access to Medicaid for persons ages 19 to 64, releasing from incarceration, releasing offenders for Medicaid benefits that become effective upon release increases their access to continuing care services. The department is committed to positive engagement and, where possible, reintegration of families during incarceration. As part of this commitment, we hired a family advocate to work in our women's medium security facility. The family advocate provides advocacy support and caseload management to women in custody with parenting difficulties. Through this program, we provide mothers with a better understanding of how to navigate the state system. We also provide coaching to improve parenting and self-advocacy skills. We also have the Family Preservation Project in our Coffee Creek Correctional Facility's minimum facility, delivering similar services to incarcerated women. In addition, the Family Preservation Project provides services to children and caregivers. And finally, I had the great privilege to serve as the chair for the Task Force on Incarcerated Veterans. The Task Force strongly believes that when incarcerated veterans are connected to federal benefits they have earned, their chance of success post-release greatly increases. Successfully identifying and connecting them to their federal benefits consequently reduces potential costs to the state by eliminating the need for expensive safety net services such as housing, health care, and living expenses. Through the commitment and dedication of task force members, recommendations on how to create a formalized veterans program within the Department of Corrections were developed, and several pilot programs were started out of the partnerships established between task force members.
Speaking of veterans, yes. Is it possible to get TRICARE for those incarcerated?
Co-Chair Winters, is it possible to track them?
No, to get TRICARE.
It's military insurance.
Military insurance.
I have to check on that. That
now, I know that we can't do Medicaid.
Right.
But is it possible?
Their benefits are suspended while they come to us.
Oh, okay.
Madam Co-Chair, I see
Chris out there doing. Yes.
One of the things that we've been working so closely with the Department of Veterans Affairs, and Director Smith has been instrumental in improving services to veterans inside. Alongside Ms. Stewart's division, we have been working with those in our care and custody to ensure that the family on the outside still maintain their benefits while the individual, because those in our care and custody assumed if they lost them, so did the family. So that's been a great process improvement.
Yes, and that was one of the pilots that we started with ODVA. They now come into intake once or twice a month. They meet with those who identify as being a vet. They verify their veteran status, and they provide them with information on how to reapportion their benefits, how to suspend the benefits that need to be suspended. And then upon release, ODVA and the Federal Veterans Administration reach in and help prepare those individuals for release in providing them and assisting them in connecting to services and resources upon release. So it's been a great partnership through this task force. So it was a great honor to have served as chair for the task force, and I look forward to improving services provided to incarcerated vets in the future. Thank you. That concludes my presentation. I'm happy to take final questions.
Representative Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Heidi, maybe I missed it. Where are we beyond the pilot programs for the veterans, or is it being put out system-wide yet?
So, Co-Chair Winters, Rep. Huffman, the pilot is providing the services at intake. So for those coming in, identifying and verifying who truly are vets. What we found was when individuals come to the Department of Corrections, we had a questionnaire and we said, are you a veteran? And we found that veterans were not identifying themselves, and people who weren't veterans were checking the box as yes. So they don't trust the Department of Corrections when they first come to us. And so that's why it's so important to actually have ODVA up at intake. So it's not a Department of Corrections person talking to them. It's a vet talking to them, or somebody representing the Veterans Association. And so we're working on getting more accurate data now. They're verifying who those vets are. And so all of those, we're calling it a pilot, but anybody coming through intake now is getting those services. And then they go out into all of our institutions. Upon release, the release services are provided across the state as well, not just in institutions. So we're piloting to see how well that works. In the task force report, it does say to broaden these services and to provide a more robust veterans program within the Department of Corrections, obviously takes staff, so there are some dollars outlined on what that would cost.
Representative Barker.
And it just, you guys have done seem to be doing a great job taking care of the families and the connections of the visitation, everything else. And I'm sure some of the people have families that are far away and with children. And the good Senator Winters and I saw it down in Angola. They had a program called Malachi Dads, which I'd have to ask you what that means. But the Malachi part, but they had the faith-based community would come in and they'd set up, and they would actually film the dad reading a book to the child, and then they would send the book and the video to the child. And I just wondered if you had anything like that. It seemed like a great program.
Yes, Co-Chair Winters, Representative Barker, we do. We have that program in our women's prison, and then we do have that program, not in every male facility, but some.
Good. Well, thank you. Mm-hmm. That's good to hear.
Thank you.
Thank you. That was fast. Forgive me.
And I believe Jeremiah is coming up next. And
that's correct, Madam Co-Chair. So speaking of fast, I was remiss in pointing out what we need to get through today in order to preserve tomorrow for public testimony.
We'll be hopeful.
And I am hopeful. So we get Mr. Stromberg here, who is our assistant director responsible for community corrections. He has had a long tenure in public safety here in Oregon, formerly with Multnomah County Department of Community Justice. Also from the parole board, serving both as a member of the parole board and the executive director before the Department of Corrections was fortunate enough to steal him and bring him into this role in 2012. And with that, I will turn it over to Assistant Director Stromberg.
Thank you, Director. Good afternoon, Chair Winters, Chair Stark, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeremiah Stromberg, and I'm the Assistant Director for the Community Corrections Division with the Department of Corrections. And the Community Corrections Division is responsible for both direct and indirect supervision and oversight of all parole, post-prison, probation, and transitional leave services. Our direct service is divided into three main divisions, and that's our administration, our interstate compact, and direct supervision of Linn and Douglas County parole and probation services. And then our indirect oversight is with the compliance of Senate Bill 1145, which governs county authority to operate and oversee community corrections. So within the Department of Corrections, next slide, the division represents about 1.5% of the department personnel. And the governor's recommended budget would make up about 15% of the department's budget, and that is both the internal DOC budget as well as all monies that we allocate out to the counties through the various funding streams, which we'll talk about in a few minutes here. So there's two major budget drivers as it relates to community corrections in determining what the baseline funding will be. First, we have to determine a capitated rate, and that's the average cost per day of managing an offender in the community. So in accordance with statute, DOC is required to complete a time study and an actual cost study every 6 years, which creates an opportunity for the legislature to reset the community corrections budget. And so we're currently starting on a time study for the 1921 biennium, where we will look at how much time does it take and how much resource for a high-risk offender, a medium-risk offender, a low-risk. And then we capture all of that and then put the money behind it to be able to present to you that this is what it takes to supervise somebody in the community. So for 1719, what we're using is a 2012 time study, and since then, what has changed is each biennium, the inflation rates get added, as well as the caseload then adjusts and changes as we go forward. As you know, there's many bills that you'll be focused on during this session that either increase the number of people on supervision or maybe decrease that number. And so once we settle on the final number for supervision, we're able to apply that to the capitated rate to determine what that baseline funding will be. The reason that baseline funding is so important is that if the legislatively adopted budget falls below the baseline funding, then this would trigger what's called opt-out. And opt-out is what allows a county to return parole and probation services to the state. And so what we saw in 2004 is the legislatively adopted budget was below the baseline budget provided by DOC, and Linn and Douglas County exercised their right to return those services to the state, and therefore we directly supervise within those counties. It was the E board later in 2004 that reconvened and said, let's get that funding back up before any more counties decide to jump ship, and ended up fully funding community corrections at that time. And so since the passage of the 1145 bill in 1996, 2004 was the only time opt-out has been triggered, and we saw the two counties return. They do have the right under statute to retake community corrections at any point in time, and to date they've been satisfied with the services through DOC. So what this graph here shows you is a breakdown of the overall community corrections budget. Yeah. And as you can see, there's multiple funding streams.
Co-Chair Stark.
Yes.
Thank you, Co-Chair Winters. Sorry, it took me a second to think through my question. So currently, and as we move forward, you'll probably talk on this some, are there other counties currently expressing a desire to opt out if they got to that point?
Chair Winters, Representative Stark, we have not had formal conversations with any counties. However, I have had a number of counties inquire, what's the process? What are the statutes or rules that are applicable to opt out? And so I have been answering basic questions and providing education, but no county has come forward saying we absolutely will if the funding is below the baseline. And so on this chart, what we have is all of the different funding streams that within the governor's recommended budget as it relates to community corrections. And so we provide allocations for small pots of specific offenders, like the sexually violent, dangerous offenders, up to the large blue Pac-Man, if you will, which is the overall grant and aid budget for community corrections. And that's the one that sets the determination for opt-out. The agency request budget, as determined by the formula for the 17-19 biennium, is $272 million. And as you'll see with the governor's budget at $239 million, it takes two significant reductions within that budget. The first is House Bill 2238 would reduce possession of a controlled substance from a felony to a misdemeanor. And so the governor's budget makes the assumption that this population then would not be a part of this felony supervision rate and formula that we provide to the counties. And so that would equate to about a $19 million savings if we no longer supervised anyone who came onto supervision or, I'm sorry, was convicted of a possession of a controlled substance. Second, the governor's budget does include a 5% reduction to the overall grant and aid budget. That equates to about $13 million, and that amount would trigger the opt-out if not, if the legislature were to adopt the governor's budget as stated. And so it's important to recognize the $19 million changes the caseload, doesn't trigger an opt-out, doesn't change how we go about formulating the capitated rate, but the $13 million reduction would at least give counties that option. In regards to individual counties then, so if we take the blue portion of the pie, we then look at the felony population within each county and give each county their percentage of the felony population. So for instance, Multnomah County makes up about 21% of the overall felony population. Linn County makes up about 4.5%. And so whatever the final budget is, each county will get their allocated share at that time. So now I want to talk a little bit about specifically how we distribute the grant and aid and some of the other support services that we provide, including the Interstate Compact and then some of the statewide programs like TransLeave and the Family Alternative Sentencing Program. So as we move forward, it's important to understand the four populations that are a part of the funding allocation and that fall under supervision. We supervise 31,526 offenders in the state of Oregon, and that's broken out by local control, which are those serving a year or less in the local county jail, the parole and post-prison population. This is a little unique to Oregon. We're one of the few states where everyone who leaves our institutions will serve a period of supervision on the back end. And we still have traditional parole for those that the parole board releases who have committed crimes prior to 1989 or after 89 if it was murder, aggravated murder, or sentenced as a dangerous offender. So we still have a small true parole population, if you will. And then about 16,000, a little more than 16,000 on probation. And so those that, in lieu of a prison sentence, were given a period of supervision. And then we have approximately 359 individuals on any given day who are out in the community on our short-term transitional leave program.
Are those distributed around the state, Jeremiah?
Chair Winters, as far as the transitional leave population, fairly equally to their overall felony breakout population. So Multnomah County does receive 20 to 25% of the trans leave population. Every single county is participating. Not a single county has said we won't take trans leavers. Denials are based usually on available housing resources or if the inmate doesn't have a solid release plan that as a county or as the department that we say, you're not a viable candidate at this time.
So there is a process of planning prior to them getting in back into the county through TransLeave.
Chair Winters, yes, there is. And as you asked of Assistant Director Heidi Stewart, the process is the same with one additional step, actually. Anyone, once their release plan is completed, it must go through my office for final approval to go out on trans leave, where we weigh both the county's position on the trans leaver as well as the institution. We weigh all of the behaviors. We double check that they're statutorily eligible. And then ultimately, we are the parole board, if you will, for that population within my shop, making determinations of when a person will return or if they'll remain in the community. And so with this population, with all four of these populations, we have a very formal process with the counties by which they obtain their grant and aid funding to supervise these populations. Counties must provide us with a biennial plan that's been approved through their local public safety coordinating councils. They do this for both their grant and aid money and the Measure 57 drug enhancement monies that they receive. Their plan must outline what services, what supervision, what sanctions they're going to provide with this money. And those plans are then reviewed by my office. We send them back for modification. We send them back with questions to ensure that these monies are being utilized appropriately for the felony supervision within their community. Once we've approved it, we do fund them on a quarterly basis, and they may make changes to their plan and modify them with approval from the Department of Corrections to do so. So there's a lot of communication and a lot of work between us and all 36 counties. We require Lynn and Douglas to go through the same process, have their plans approved locally, since they must work with their local public safety providers to ensure that, again, that these monies are being used effectively. I will
Co-chair Stark.
Thank you, Co-chair. How can we have access to those plans, or how do we get access to those plans to if we were curious about what the different counties are doing in their proposals?
Chair Winters, Representative Stark, yes, we keep both hard and electronic copies of all of the plans at the Department of Corrections, and we could certainly provide you any or all counties that you're interested in looking at.
Thank you.
Just a follow-up question: are there standardization that is required of all counties, and then are there variables that may be based on the uniqueness of a county in the planning?
Chair Winters, it's a combination of both. Both statute and rule outline some very specific parameters for supervision. Statute outlines the conditions that must be met and followed while a person is on supervision. And then the county has the ability to create and adapt programs and approaches that they find ideal for their population or their system. For instance, some counties run day reporting centers where if you're not working, you're going to report daily to a center where you're getting some job skill training, perhaps working on your GED, doing some other programmatic work. Other counties run work release centers, and they use that either as a sanction or as a housing option. And again, not talking about our inmate population, but just generally within the supervised probation population. So you have a variety of differences, all built on the same foundation of the conditions of supervision and the authority of a parole officer outlined by statute. I do want to talk about some of the outcome measures that we focus on during the during supervision. I will tell you that, and again, for more than 100 years, conditions have been in place in Oregon for supervision. And they are the earliest conditions focused on maintaining work, building positive support systems, refraining from indecent amusement, and staying out of saloons. And while our terminology has certainly changed, those concepts still remain the crux of supervision today.
I love indecent amusement in saloons. That's great.
And, Senator, it certainly speaks to who you hang out with and how you spend your time as
exactly.
a reflection of who you are.
And yeah, that, they're nice family-level terms.
That's right. Yes, they were.
Watch a kid. We can't be going to dinner.
But as you'll see from this measure.
No, you do not have a family.
What this measure shows for us is that about 60% of our probation and post-prison population successfully complete their term of supervision. This doesn't mean that the other 40% failed. What it means is that they did not meet all of the conditions that the court or the board of parole imposed upon them. They may not have completed alcohol and drug treatment or mental health treatment before they ended their period of supervision. And so we don't deem them as successfully having completed. They may still owe restitution. Many of our
Senator Steiner-Haywood has a question.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but help me understand. It looks like the probation group is a little bit above where we were 6 years ago. But the parole, post-prison supervision group, is not doing quite as well. Is that because they're a more complicated group than they were 6 years ago, because more people are getting diverted before they even go in? Or what explains the drop from 67% to 62%? And I hear what you're saying about some of them are relatively small reasons, but are we making things the conditions too complicated and setting them up to fail, or do we not have the resources in place to help them succeed, or all the above, as my good chair says, or what do you think?
Yeah, Chair Winters, Senator Steiner-Haywood, it's a combination of the things that you said. We saw after 2009 a loss of a lot of our local treatment programs throughout the state, many of which have been rebuilt through the justice reinvestment monies and the increase back into the community corrections budget. I have no data to equate it to more departures from prison or changes in conditions. They have been fairly standard. It really has to do with the level of risks and needs. When we receive an individual on supervision, they need alcohol and drug treatment, they need parenting classes, they've been court ordered to attend, say, domestic violence as well. They need to find and maintain employment, they need to finish education, and we can't do all of those at once.
Mm-hmm.
And a 18-month to 3-year period many times is not enough time to complete all of them. We measure this very critically, and we say unless they've all been met and you've paid every cent of your restitution, you haven't successfully met everything the court required of you. It doesn't mean you're extended, and many of those folks don't ultimately then recidivate or commit a new crime, but of everything that was placed upon them, they were not able to meet it within the 18-month to 36-month supervision period.
Thank you.
Follow-up.
Thank you. So, two questions. The first is, do you have the ability to provide us with some kind of a breakdown about the different reasons that people don't successfully complete? I mean, of the 38% that don't successfully complete, how many of them are because of restitution versus other reasons that they would be considered unsuccessful? And the second is, what then happens if they don't successfully? What happens to that 38% that haven't successfully completed? Does that become a permanent blot on their record that could further keep them out of gainful employment, or does it result in I'm the newbie, I'm like one of the newbies, so I just need some education. Does it result in reincarceration? What happens when they don't complete?
Chair Winters, Senator Steiner-Haywood, to your first question, yes, we can absolutely get you a breakdown of those that did not successfully complete. To your second question, give me a few minutes to think on it. If we could maybe revisit that in a few minutes.
And I'm going to call on Representative Sanchez. The reentry task force had extensively this discussion, particularly as it dealt with restitution and some of those other issues, and I'm not sure whether we came up with a resolution of how to address that. But yes, it is one of those barriers, can be multiple barriers that are out there that that become a part of that 38 percent that he's talking about. Representative Sanchez, so.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. You sort of messed me up there because I was thinking about that question about people going back. Are they actually doing something again and going back to prison? But then also, isn't that parole number again folks that were much older population? No.
Chair Winters, Representative Sanchez. They are slightly older as a cohort,
yes,
than the probation population. That is true. So there is a slight age difference. They are also a slightly higher risk and higher need, as they don't have as many supports in the community, as they've been removed for a period of time, and they're coming out with a lot less at their disposal than many of those placed on probation. And if I may, Chair Winters, you're absolutely right. One of the things we're looking at, I know that there is a bill related to a certificate of good standing if you've successfully completed your supervision. And if we based it on our current measures of how we look at that, only 60% would be eligible. And so we need to look at how we're measuring what's a successful completion, and then specifically what some of those impacts may be. Senator Steiner Hayward, to your question, for some it is that their probation gets extended, depending on the length of supervision, the charge. The courts do have the ability to extend if you haven't met all of your obligations. For post-prison supervision, it can't be extended. Some of these did not successfully complete because they did recidivate and are back in custody or picked up new charges. That is a percentage of the group, and we can certainly, as I said, provide some breakdown as to why we were seeing such a large percentage not meet all of their conditions.
That'd be very helpful, Mr. Stromberg. Thank you
Absolutely.
Very much.
Next, we also measure treatment participation and employment rates. I will tell you that we are encouraged by these numbers. First, with employment, when you consider the fact that those that leave our custody have a 5% employment rate upon release. So we have a 95% unemployment rate at the beginning of supervision, as far as those that have a stable job waiting for them upon return. And yet we're able to raise that up above 50% of being employed during their term of supervision. This is encouraging. Many of our adults that we're working with are just not ready to work. We need to address the mental health issues, the addiction issues, before putting them back into the workforce, let alone the collateral consequences that many of you are already talking about that impact a person with a felony record, certainly a felony record and on supervision at the same time, from being able to obtain employment. So 50% is encouraging. It's certainly a great increase from where they begin with us, but it's also the reason we measure it is we want to see greater outcomes by the time a person is off supervision.
Yes, Senator.
I understand that it's a little tough to say because there's so many factors, but what number do you think you could get to, and what would it take to get you there?
Chair Winters, Senator Steiner Hayward, there are a number of factors. I am very encouraged when we look at ways to eliminate collateral consequences. Initiatives such as Ban the Box, allowing a person at least the opportunity to have an interview, our parole and probation officers, depending on the employer and if the person on supervision so desires, they write letters of support. They'll go and visit with the employer and give assurances. We have some employers that we have great relationships out there who want the folks we're working with because they also know that they have the assistance of the probation department behind them if things start to go sideways. So the more we can do to eliminate those collateral consequences of a felony record, should the decision be made to reduce PCS penalties to misdemeanors, those things will have a direct impact on employment. So I think we always need to keep employment in mind. We also need more involvement from the business community. They have to be more engaged and involved. We have some great business leaders who have been engaged with us, but certainly not statewide. They need to understand what great skills you heard from both Mike Gower and Heidi Stewart, the work programs, the education that we're providing. We have some of the only welders in the state who are looking for work, and employers who need to know that and become more engaged with us. We have boot makers, and we have two large boot making companies within the state of Oregon. They need to be tapping those resources. So building that connectivity with the business community is vitally important.
Thank you.
I guess what you're saying, we either help to get employment so that the person becomes contributing to the tax base and the economy, rather than a consumer of the resources. And I think this is something that throughout this state, I'm fond of saying, I find it very interesting, because when we talked about the Constitution, and somehow we forget about that Reformation part of the Constitution. And it's very much embedded and emboldened in what was the principle when we actually formed this state. And yet the barriers that you're talking about that exist, we somehow just say, but them, not us. And I'm fond of saying, but for the grace of God, go all of us. And so, I just need to put that out there, because there is a need for the greater community. Including the employers and all of us, to actually address this. I said the individuals have done, once they have paid their debt to society, to us, what we require, and become responsible, then I think we need to try to find a way that we do try to make certain that they are employed, that they are taking care of their families, and that they don't recidivate and go back. Because the more that we keep building these cities, then we're not going to actually be able to educate our children in other parts of our state. So, for me, it is about talking about how we actually begin to address some of these issues, and I want to thank you for the work. And yes, Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jeremiah, do you have folks that work with the people spread throughout the state and our regional workforce? Like, I, until recently, was a member of the East Cascades Workforce Region, the board. Do your folks work with them to identify, because Portland area that has the bootmaker, for example, they've got a workforce region that could maybe help connect the dots on the bootmakers, for example, with the employment there?
Chair Winters, Representative Huffman, we do, but it's spotty. As 36 counties operate parole and probation independently, those that do have more robust public safety coordinating councils, some have reentry councils locally, where they do have a higher level of connectivity. And certainly in some of our larger counties, we have it, but it's spotty around the state. It's an area certainly we need some improvements.
Just aside, I know that our Chamber of Commerce here began taking this on because of the members, and we began throughout this community of actually having conversation throughout this community on this particular issue and trying to recruit employers to become much more involved and to hire, thanks to Dick Withnail and others in this community. And it is something that I think we cannot just say that it is the responsibility of DOC and parole and probation. That's just not the way communities work. It is a responsibility of all of us. And so I know that our chamber did become involved in this particular topic and conversation.
Marion County is the gold standard for the state. That is true.
And Madam Co-Chair and Representative Huffman, I'll just add that through the Governor's Reentry Council, and with Dick Withnail on the council, previously as a member and chair of the Business Implementation Committee, he was attempting to steal the notion in Marion County and bring it to the statewide level. But we have, as Mr. Stromberg said, lots of room for improvement.
Lastly, on this chart, we also have our treatment engagement numbers, which stay pretty constant around the 30% mark. I would say that that is a success. First, we have a percentage of the population that don't need treatment. We also have a percentage that have already completed treatment, so we do this as a snapshot of those currently engaged. And then lastly, a portion that just isn't ready for treatment. And so we do a lot of pre-treatment readiness and stabilization before engaging folks, because certainly putting someone in too early would not be effective. So as you can see, that stays about constant and does mean that there is waiting lists in most of our communities as it relates to many of our treatment programs. So moving forward, supporting victims and holding offenders accountable to the damage they've done is a primary focus of supervision. With this chart, we've been tracking both restitution payment as well as community service. Again, in regards to restitution, the measure shows that the average amount of restitution paid by the time supervision ended that reporting year. If only 50% of our population is working, as you can imagine, we're not getting the full amount of restitution paid during the supervision period. Supervision ends, you are still responsible for your restitution, so we're sort of the beginning point of payment in hopes to get folks, again, working, stabilized, and ability to pay and on a payment plan before they end their supervision and have to continue to pay that. But during the course of supervision, we do see, as you can see from here, about 21% completely paid off.
What percentage of the individuals are that you have in your custody are making child support payments and those forms of, quote, and restitution, do you know?
Chair Winters, for those on supervision, I don't know. We could look to see if we could pull that data. We'd have to work with all 36 counties, as that's not a required data point that they have to enter into our system. But we could certainly look to see if we can get an answer. And then moving forward, we do have a probation recidivism chart and a post-prison. Director Peter spent some time on Monday talking about the new definition of recidivism as it relates to any arrest, conviction, or incarceration for a new crime. And that came out of House Bill 3194. So what we have done in working with the Criminal Justice Commission is to break those three components out. And as the director had pointed out, we're on Monday, we have a 48% re-arrest rate for a new crime. It does not mean that they were guilty. As you see, about 40% are then ultimately convicted of a new misdemeanor or felony, with a 12% reincarceration rate for our probation cohort.
Of that 12%, what came back to see you?
Chair Winters, we could break that out. A portion of them are serving local time, as they were sentenced to 1 year or less, and then those that received more than 365 days are back in our care and custody.
So it would be interesting to note how many of them return to your institution and not the jail.
We can pull that number for you. And then likewise, we have it broken out by the post-prison numbers as well. So I won't spend a lot of time there other than to say they're slightly higher than probation. Again, as we talked about, higher risk, higher need, less support in the community.
Senator Steiner-Hayward.
Sorry. Yes. One quick question. How do these numbers, these percentages, well, first of all, are we able to compare on an apples-to-apples basis for other states or things like that? And how do they compare county to county in Oregon? So that we can think about how do we disseminate best practices and support all of our counties in reaching the best levels. Can you just educate me a little bit about those things?
Yeah, Chair Winters, Senator Steiner-Hayward. Nationally, there hasn't been a 50-state study done since, I believe, about 2004. Comparing a true apples to apples. What I can share with you is I work with my counterparts around the nation. When we look at recidivism studies, which typically focus on felony reconvictions and return to DOCs, we are in the top percentage of the highest success rates. I can share with you that most of them are seeing reconviction rates in the 60% and higher. Rearrest rates in the 75% and higher. Again, it's not a true apples to apples. Arrest practices are different. Incarceration crimes are different. Those that still have felony PCS versus misdemeanor PCS. Sure. It skews it to some degree. For counties, we do have all of that data. We do track this individually by county, and we have the trends going back to 1998. So we can share with you by county and trend it over the last 20 years.
Thank you, Mr. Stromberg.
It would be helpful, though, because when we change the recidivism definition, that might be different. Wouldn't that be skewed?
So, Chair Winters, the numbers changed. So the original definition was felony reconviction, and so they are buried in the orange line. That population is in there. What you have now is felony misdemeanor as well as arrest and incarceration. So we still pull out that felony line because we were so used to working with it, and it is a great measure within the DOC because it means those returning to us most of the time. But they are buried within the orange line.
And Madam Co-Chair, if I can just clarify one thing, it was 2004 data in a 2011 or 2012
Thank
Pew
you.
Report.
Yes, I was thinking about the data here. You typically need 3 to 5 years to be able to look at the recidivism rate. All right, moving forward, trying to keep us on time, but so I just want to highlight a few of the other programs that we manage within the Department of Corrections for the state. So first of all, as I said, we do directly supervise Lynn and Douglas County. That's 2,600 offenders that state parole and probation officers are overseeing, and we work very closely with those communities to manage their populations. We do program evaluations of all community programs that receive general fund dollars. Senate Bill 267 requires that 75% of all state-funded programs must be evidence-based. So what we look at is, do the programs that are utilizing these monies, do they have the elements of successful programs? Are they focused on behavior change? Do they separate out high-risk from low-risk populations? Do they separate genders and not combine them into the same groups? Things that we know are more effective in a group dynamic. Are they focused on antisocial beliefs, attitudes, and behaviors, whether we're talking alcohol and drug addiction or sex offending? Are they getting to the core components? I'm pleased to tell you, of the 29 programs this biennium that we have reviewed thus far, 75% of them on the nose are meeting the standard we would expect. The 25% that are not are currently going through a corrective action plan, if you will, with the county to ensure that they adopt practices that we know are effective in changing behavior. We also are responsible for inspecting all of the jails, juvenile facilities, temporary holds and lockups around the state. We have 2 jail inspectors. We reviewed this last year, 11 juvenile detention facilities, 7 city jails and lockups, 30 police department holding cells. Anywhere a person can be detained for 24 hours, we review it to make sure it meets the statutory compliance standards of care and custody. We work with the Sheriff's Association to ensure that all of their facilities as well have been inspected and meet the requirements as well. And we help with the planning and creation of new holds and lockups to ensure that they meet statutory compliance. To date, with the exception of occasionally missing some policies or some records, we have seen great compliance with our public safety partners, and certainly we keep all of those inspections on file for review and many times receive public records requests for them as well. And then we also oversee the Interstate Compact. Last time I was before you, I told you the story of in 2009, how 4 Lakeland police officers were murdered by an Arkansas parolee who had left the state of Arkansas, gone to the state of Washington, and it just emphasized the need for states to work together to ensure that you can't merely move out of state and escape your supervision and be able to continue to commit crimes, and in this case, horrible crimes in another jurisdiction. We have a team of 4 individuals who have overseen the movement of 2,700 offenders this last year in and out of the state of Oregon. Representative Barker, at the last hearing, you had asked me, do we have more coming in or more going out? As you can see from here, 1337 came in and 1391 went out. So not that it's a success measure, but we have at least more going out of state than we have coming in, and that's how we'd like to keep it. But to that end, it's important that we work with states. Many times for someone out of state, their best chance at success is here in Oregon. And likewise, for many of those convicted in Oregon, their support systems, their chance for success is in another state. And so we have a process, federal rules and regulations that allow you to move. Since my 5 years here with Department of Corrections, I have been on the executive board for the Interstate Compact, currently serving as their vice chair, overseeing compliance for all 50 states. And so it's something we take very, very seriously. I very quickly just want to talk about a couple of the statewide programs we oversee. House Bill 3194 allowed for early discharge of your probation sentence if you were substantially compliant. You could get off 50% early. So a two-year probation could end up being a one-year if you paid all of your restitution, you were violation-free for the prior 6 months, did not commit a new crime during supervision, and were in compliance with your conditions. To date, we've seen 1,300 of our probationers move off of probation early. We do incentivize the counties by continuing to fund them for the person during that course of supervision. That does equate to about $5.4 million in the budget that the county then gets to reinvest in the higher risk offenders that they're still supervising. And we're going to work with the Criminal Justice Commission on a more robust study and to see how this population is doing long term. We just need a little bit more time before we can do that. But it is a good statistic to see that only 35 after completing supervision of the 1,300 are back on supervision for a new offense. And six of that 35 are in custody with the remaining 29 on probation. Then we move to our short-term transitional leave program, again, out of House Bill 3194. This is the 90-day program that allows those that are statutorily eligible, whose behavior has warranted an early release from our facilities, to be able to move back into the community. During this biennium, we have moved 1,700 of our adults in custody back into the community onto short-term trans leave. We've seen 122 of them during that course of supervision or trans leave return back to us as they failed the program during that first 90 days. This has been a great collaboration with the community corrections directors and the sheriffs. And again, as we were talking earlier and as you talked with Assistant Director Heidi Stewart, the county does a robust review of their plan. We look at their behavior while they've been with us during their incarceration period. They have to complete treatment. They cannot be homeless. There must be a housing mechanism, whether provided by the county or their own home to go back to. And what we have seen is that since the inception of the program, we've released 4,030 inmates out to trans leave. We have had a 1% return for committing new crimes while in the community on transitional leave. That's a great success of the program. We have brought back more for continued technical violations. If they're not reporting to their PO, they are on a tighter leash. But the counties have invested a lot of justice reinvestment and county grant and aid money into the transitional leave population. Representative Stark, your questions yesterday around work release that you said would also be for trans leave. As far as a baseline and intensive supervision, yes, the counties are providing a higher level of response. They are providing, many of them use their transition centers to house this population before allowing them to go home. We have seen monies being set aside to assist with getting IDs, work equipment, boots, gloves. A lot of our folks obviously go into the construction business. We've seen a high level of compliance with reporting and home visits. And when we don't see it, as we review this, I have a team of three individuals overseeing the program. We are working with the counties around what are you doing with this individual. Many times the county says, hey, they violated, but we want to keep working with them locally, and we make the decision you're coming back to DOC. Other times, counties have been quick to say, take them back, and we say, hey, you're going to have them in 90 days anyways. Are there some local sanctions and alternatives we could utilize to work with them? So it's been a great collaboration both ways, something we take very seriously, and certainly as a former parole board member, I don't take lightly our authority to release to the community while a person's in an inmate status. And I think the outcomes, certainly the Criminal Justice Commission two-year recidivism study shows that we are getting a significant reduced recidivism rate with this population.
Are you getting this same kind of response, cooperative response from all 36 counties? Are there some counties that are still somewhat reluctant or still have challenges?
Chair Winters, the biggest challenge we face with some counties is they would still like to operate it as a zero tolerance program. And as I outlined, our expectation is you're going to have them in 90 days. Minor technical violations should be dealt with locally. Swift, interruptive responses we know work best to change behavior. But if they're committing new crimes, if their risk is increasing even prior to those crimes, we will take them back. No county is not participating. And the only denials we're receiving from counties is when the housing option is not viable.
Okay. Senator Steiner, here with
you. Thank you. And Mr. Schumer, when we before we passed 3194, the maximum for short-term transition leave was 30 days.
Correct.
3194 allowed the option of increasing up to 90 days. How do these numbers compare percentage-wise to what we were seeing with 30-day short-term transitional leave as compared to 90-day short-term transitional leave?
Chair Winter, Senator Steiner Hayward. We were averaging only 15 inmates a month going out on trans leave with the 30-day program. It was an inmate-driven program. The department didn't encourage it. It. Quite honestly, we weren't utilizing it to any great extent. In December of 2013, when the first population was eligible for the 90-day, we increased in 1 month from 15 being the average to 115 being the average. So we dramatically flipped the program. Overall, I would say that we certainly see more violations now only because we have a larger percentage and they're out for a longer period. Mm-hmm. But it's a 4% failure rate and a 1% new criminal activity rate. And so we're extremely pleased. And the two-year recidivism study shows a 21% decrease in overall recidivism. So we're seeing, compared to their match twin who did not go out on to trans leave. And so that's where we're seeing some great success that an incentive-based program, if inmates do well in the institution, our hypothesis was you will do better in the community, and so far we're seeing that that is the case.
Follow-up.
Thank you. You and I have had this conversation before, so what I'm about to say is not a surprise to you. When you say match twin, could you describe what you mean by that, please?
Yes, Chair Winters and Senator Steiner Hayward. We are comparing to somebody. The only anomaly to that twin base is that, and the best way to describe it is if Dustin and I are the same age, are in on the same crime, have the same risk level, and Dustin does everything as he's absolutely expected to do, completes treatment, doesn't get in any trouble, and I'm committing violations, I'm getting caught with contraband. Dustin goes out on trans leave. I sit for an additional 90 days and I don't go out. Dustin is proving to recidivate after a two-year period much less than I am. What we haven't done and what you did ask of us that we're working with the Criminal Justice Commission on is looking at prior to a trans leave program, comparing Dustin to a prior Dustin.
Right.
Who had the same good behavior. And so we're still working on that study.
Thank you.
What we've tried to do is at least get some early outcomes to look at as close as we can to what is this population doing compared to those that are serving day for day and then releasing to the community.
The other factor, because I can recall some of the early data coming back where we were having a problem, particularly with violations that we thought that maybe if you work with them in the community rather than sending them back to you, and that was work that had to be done with the POs in the community and what in the community, as well as we had to do some work with through just a bomber and others with the courts. Implementing Senate Bill 3194 has been a work in evolution. I just need to put that on the record, and it's not that old when you think in terms of the changes that were being made in Oregon with trans leave and everything that we were piling on all at one time. But I do recall that the statistics today are better than the statistics that were there last year and year before. So, yes, Co-Chair Stark.
Thank you, Co-Chair Winters. Can you explain to me the difference between recidivism versus a 4% failure rate? What else is included in the failure rate that's not included in recidivism?
Sure. Chair Winters, Representative Stark, we consider a failure if you return to DOC during the trans leave period. So just looking at the 90-day. The CJC study looks at beyond, the 2 years beyond. We will take you back for repeated technical violations. You fail to report to your PO. You don't attend treatment. Not necessarily the first time unless you truly are a high-risk individual, but repeated violations over your first week or two out in the community where it's clear you're not going to participate in this, we bring you back. A PO's threshold for alleging a new criminal behavior is much lower than the standard for a conviction. And so even without a conviction, if you were arrested for a behavior that constitutes new criminal behavior, we will yank you back and allow the court process to continue forward. It may be dismissed, it may be acquitted, but we will not release you back onto trans leave having been arrested even for behavior that constitutes a new crime. So it's a series of technical as well as potentially new criminal behavior.
Follow up. Thank you. And a couple minutes ago you referred to them, those who have completed treatment. Is there treatment required once they leave, you know, your facility, once they actually go out on leave? Is there a minimum amount of treatment required in the community by everybody? And I understand that there's different levels required based on the transitional plan, but is there a minimum treatment required?
Chair Winters, Representative Stark, no, there's not a standard treatment base for everyone who's going out. It is solely based on individual risk and need. So for many, there is. For some, there may not be a treatment component. Let's go to the family sentencing alternative. I am going to finish up on you today so that you don't have to hear from me tomorrow. So just one slide back. And the family sentencing alternative program came out of House Bill 3508. This is a departure from prison and you stay on probation. The primary goal, being modeled after a Washington State program, is to keep those that can be successful on probation and are primary custodial parents to continue to reside in the community under supervision and intensive supervision with DHS involvement. One of the primary goals is to reduce the utilization of foster care for children who don't need it. We started this program a year ago, and what we have seen is we have seen 75 men and women go through the program, primarily women. 139 children have been impacted. As it's only been a year, everyone is still participating. We've had two that have failed and have been revoked to prison. But the remaining 73 are still in the program. We're going to work with the Criminal Justice Commission on a robust study as well to look at how they do long-term. And certainly, as most of you know, there's a variety. I believe there's four bills currently that expand or change or add some component to a family sentencing alternative program. And so certainly to answer questions at another time as to that program and its expansion. And then lastly, just looking forward, a number of things that we are focused on. Assistant Director Heidi Stewart talked about a gender-specific risk instrument for women in our institutions. We are using that in the community as well so that we can better develop plans that are specific to the risks and needs of the women that we supervise. More counties this last year developed women-specific caseloads than we've ever had before in the state, which has been very exciting to see. Our goal is to be responsive to each individual on supervision, race, gender, crime type, And so the more we can specialize it and focus on specific needs, the more effective we are. Lastly, DOC is responsible to oversee the structure of the structured sanctions grid. So what communities can use to address violations? We had the first grid in the nation in 1988. It's time to update it. We've done some small modifications, but we're in the middle of working with the counties on more sanctioning options that research has shown to be effective to disrupt and change behavior. And lastly, I just want to point out I'm very proud of the collaboration between local county government and DOC. The community corrections budget in our system is a great model of the state and the local government working together through the pass-through of dollars, our oversight and accountability that that money is being spent appropriately, shared training, shared supervision resources, the interstate compact. And so I certainly want to extend my appreciation to the community corrections directors, county commissioners, and the sheriffs, and our other public safety partners to make community corrections as successful as it is. And I will stop there and answer any other questions you may have.
My only other question, and you can bring the information back, and that's what's the involvement with the CCOs around the state, particularly the individuals that we were able to get enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan. And what, how receptive that has been, and the access issue. So, if anything that you have on that particular issue, I'd be happy to hear about it. And I'm sure that my good senator to my right would also like to hear about how what we're seeing with our relationship with the CCOs. I know that we were. The cooperation from the Oregon Health Authority and DOC working together to facilitate and make this happen, I thought was good collaboration. So I'm just now interested in how now the handoff to the communities and what's occurring there.
Chair Winters, we can do that.
Thank you. Any questions? Concerns? With that, thank you. We are adjourned.
Thank you, committee. Thank you, committee.